to Where Brains Meet Beauty, hosted by Jodi Katz, founder and creative director of Base Beauty Creative Agency.
Hi, Jodi. How are you?
Melanie, great to see you. It's a Friday. I look like it's a Friday.
I feel like it's a Friday, but shockingly, we are already heading back into back-to-school season.
Yes, we've had a lot of fun vacations in my household, college touring in my household. I'm going to have two high schoolers in a minute. Very exciting.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Well, we have lots to talk about today, lots of interesting topics coming up on this week's episode, and wanted to start by diving into something we've been working on at Base Beauty, our creative agency, our day jobs, featuring one of our clients, our amazing client, Epion Skincare. So this is a clinical skincare brand, and they came to us with a challenge. They wanted to scale beyond professional channels into broader consumer awareness and e-commerce success.
Right. And all of our work, of course, starts with data-driven creativity. 68% of U.S. adults have made purchases through their social feeds. So Meta is a really important discovery and conversion platform for our client Epionce. So we really enhanced our Meta program for Epionce this year. And Kim, our amazing lead for that department, developed this incredible strategic two-pronged approach. She's engaging new and existing audiences through broad reach and retargeting, and optimizing customer acquisition costs through testing and evergreen campaigns. So very sophisticated, and it's working.
Yeah, it absolutely is working. We had amazing results. In just one quarter, the revenue increased by 88%. Their ROAS increased by 66%. Add to cart rates, which was a really interesting metric to track, this increased by 50%. And conversion rates jumped 67%. So amazing success for Epionce.
I love this. We did this reboot using our content, which was sensorial beauty. So a mix of course, the smart thinking by Kim, but also having the right creative. So we love talking about with our friends in the industry what it takes to succeed in marketing today. And this is a really thoughtful case study. So it will be something that you can download from my LinkedIn.
Yeah, please do, everyone. We love to show off our Base Beauty work when we talk about our podcast guests as well. So Jodi, who do we have on the show today?
This is so fun. This is Kevin Kim. He's the Director of Beauty and Personal Care Investment Banking at Raymond James. And he's carved out a distinct niche by focusing on founder-backed brands in this rapidly evolving industry. And in this episode, he talks about how early in his career, he realized that beauty was not just a good fit, but it's where he could thrive, thanks to his analytical mindset and deep interest in consumer behavior, which is really just like paid performance marketing, which we were just talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this conversation. And I love this question that often comes up for me when I'm interviewing candidates, like, what does a typical day look like? And Kevin Kim was talking about how no 2 days for him look the same in his world. And I loved hearing about his onboarding of new team members. He takes them there, you know, they work in investment banking, and he takes them on an immersive retail field trip to Sephora, Ulta, and other key spaces that we play in all day long. But it really is that first initial moment to understand the consumer and really experience it from the ground up.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall on that field trip. Maybe he'll invite me along so I can be a co-guide with him. It would be so fun to talk to people who are new to the category.
Yeah, I love that. So this episode is really amazing for people who are brand builders, investors, or just passionate about beauty and consumer trends. Kevin brings a really thoughtful and grounded perspective on what it takes to succeed in this fast-moving space.
Well, we learned so much about this episode. It ends with a really, really great game about great coffee and great wine spots in the city. So this actually could be a checklist for people looking for their weekend plans.
Absolutely. Let's hear more from Kevin Kim. This is episode 290.
Hey, beauty founders, brand builders, and industry insiders, are you ready to level up?
Our friends at Kosako are back for the 9th annual edition of Beauty Connect. It is happening November 3rd through the 5th at the gorgeous Fairmont Century Plaza in Los Angeles.
Beauty Connect is the industry's go-to problem-solving platform. Our COO, Sarah Lavallee, will be joining this year for Base Beauty.
You'll also be surrounded by some of your favorite brands, Supergoop, House Labs, L'Occitane, Nordstrom, Bloomingdale's, and Beekman 1802.
We're talking curated one-on-one meetings, a luxe gift bag, intimate closed-door dinners with retailers, investors, and your sharpest peers.
Head to beautyconnectla.com and use our code WBMB for 10% off your ticket.
Let us know if you'll be attending. Your next big break could be in that room. Welcome to Where Brains Meet Beauty. We're excited to discuss consulting and consumer dynamics with Kevin Kim, Director of Beauty and Personal Care Investment Banking at Raymond James. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Jody.
Thanks for being here today.
Really great to be here.
Okay, Kevin, we're going to go back in time because this is a career journey show, and our career dreams start when we're quite young. So like at 10, 11 years old, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Well, at 10, I was pretty much, you know, like I'm the oldest of two sons, and kind of as like the, you know, model child, I was supposed to basically follow in my, you know, parents' footsteps. They're both doctors. And it was kind of like implied and kind of understood that I was just supposed to be like, be a doctor, right? And that was kind of really it. And then I think at some point, the transition of like, I want to be my own man, I want to be my own person and not do what my parents did. I think that kind of clicked at some point later on in high school.
What were their medical specialties?
They're both psychiatrists.
Oh, interesting.
And we'll get back to that because there's a lot of things around psychiatry and therapy in general that kind of very much, like, it's fascinating, like it applies every day to what I do for a living now. But yeah, like, you know, going to medical school and some type of medical career was very much kind of understood. All my kind of schooling was around that. And then I think at some point, in addition to kind of wanting to be my own person, you know, forging my own identity and path separate from my parents, I think I really liked and wanted to do something a little bit more global rather than kind of very local and, you know, localized to like a specific area.
So how old were you when you were like, oh, I don't need to become a doctor, I can pursue a different path?
I was like 17, 18 years old, okay. 19 years old.
And like did you reveal that to your parents at that time?
I was kind of going through it, and I think around the time when applying for colleges, I think that's when it really started to come out. And I think for them, like, they wanted to be supportive, but, you know, they had no idea what that world was like. And I think, you know, the conclusion of, like, coming more towards investment banking and something a little bit more global in nature, they're like, we don't have anyone in our family who does that. Like, we can't really help you. Mm-hmm. It's really risky. That sounds really scary. Don't you want to go back to medicine? And this would be a theme that they would come back to constantly where, like, even in my, like, analyst and associate years, when I'm in my, you know, like, young 20s, they're like, you know, Kevin, it's never too late to go back to medical school. So, you know, that was, like, a thing. But,
yeah. You bring up that whole college process. My son's going to be a senior in high school, so we're, you know, in this whole college world. It's actually quite fun as a parent. I don't know that it was fun as the kid, you know, because you feel all that pressure as a parent. It's really fun to be a part of this. He does not want to be a doctor, but he does actually want to study business. So maybe he'll call you when he's a little older.
Sure.
Okay, so let's talk about how you got your first job in this world. So you went to school, you studied business.
Yes.
What was that first job?
So it was investment banking. I joined Houlihan Lokey. It's another investment bank. And I basically found a job doing M&A in their financial services team. So basically doing M&A for banks and lending type companies, insurance companies. I will say it was a really good kind of primer to understanding business and kind of analytics. But it was very quickly on, like within the first year, that like, oh my goodness, I don't want to be an expert in this type of, you know, this sector. And thinking through kind of like, do I want to be the go-to guy when anyone has a question on like mortgage servicing rights? Like what 21-year-old wants to really be that kind of thing? And I think independent of that, I think I've always had a personal passion and curiosity for, you know, what is the business side of these big brands that we as consumers all kind of gravitate towards, the business of fashion, consumer, et cetera. And I've always wanted to be like, thinking, can I merge what I have right now to kind of that side of the thing to really understand, you know, how the sausage is made? And at some point I'm thinking like, okay, well, consumer is a big sector. Like I want to transition out of what I'm doing right now, doing, you know, insurance company M&A or bank M&A to doing something that I care about. So after 2 years, I transitioned over to Financo. You know, it was an independent boutique investment bank based here in New York. They've been around for many, many years. Traditionally known for apparel and fashion M&A, which was very much my cup of tea. My hero at the time was Domenico De Sole. And I'm like, I want to be kind of like something like him at some point. And then when I arrived, fortune would have it, I met Vinette, who is, you know, as many of you know, kind of a living legend in M&A in the beauty space. She was just starting to kind of hit her stride around that time. And I joined her and it was just basically me and her just kind of, you know, working with founders on figuring out their growth objectives and, you know, raising capital. And the capital raising dynamic back then in like 2014, 2015 was very, very different to what it is now. So I think really kind of working and being there as like a trusted sounding board, as like a Sherpa for these founders to be like, how can you then go about doing what you want to do? And then that slowly led into the next deal and next deal and next deal. And it really kind of changed when one of the first deals we've done, it then turned around full circle where the founder then basically came back to hire us to then do the full exit. So that was, you know, we helped Lily Gordon, the founder of First Day Beauty way back when, raising money from growth equity, private equity, et cetera. And then a couple of years later, she's like, okay, Vinette, Kevin, it's time. Let's figure out what to do. And then, you know, we were just kind of appointed as the trusted advisor, and we ultimately sold that to P&G in 2018.
I want to hear about what's different now versus then, but I want to go back to what we were talking about in your that first role.
Sure.
Because when I think back to my first job out of college, I didn't love the job, but I actually like pull from my experiences and learning there all the time and running my business, Space Beauty. And even, you know, I was like a punk, I didn't know anything then, but I just absorbed so much that's valuable. So what skills and talents are you using today that you actually formed at that first role?
I think at the first role, it was very heavy on analytics, not to get so into the weeds of like how like a mortgage company works, but like you're basically going through like reams and reams of data, basically all these things like FICO scores, like all these things, and like trying to figure out, okay, what does the general data show in terms of a story? And I think that same, you know, kind of analytical framework of like analyzing D2C shopping behavior, and you know, how does the data kind of translate into like the story over time? I think that's very much kind of, you know, a key transferable skill set. And I think the second thing was during my first, call it, you know, 18 months or so in my first job, there was quite a lot of turnover in that particular team. And whenever that would happen, the team never really backfilled that role. So like the person immediately above me would leave for something else. And they'll be like, okay, well, Kevin, you just have to figure it out. And I think that at the time it was a little stressful, but it kind of forced you to like grow in a way where you're like, you just figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then I think that step change really helped in terms of, especially in the early days where it was just candidly me and Vinette just like, you know, figuring it out and like really building kind of the history, the expertise, and also the just general reputation of being a trusted advisor for founders. And then, you know, fast forward many, many years now, you know, we're in a privileged position where people kind of have heard about us. Mm-hmm. And we are kind of in a position now to be more thoughtful about where we spend our time, et cetera.
So the theme that we have today is career capital, voices in finance and investing. And I'm so glad that we have this theme because we actually have never done this before. We've had, you know, tons of CEOs on the podcast. We're almost 300 episodes. So we've had influencers and artists. We've never focused on this category of knowledge. So for our listeners who this theme is new to, what skills and what kind of like energetically do you need to have success in a career like yours?
So I'd say my specific kind of career path is a little unusual in that I specialized or ended up specializing in a specific subsector within the broader consumer retail kind of area very quickly early on. And generally at most investment banks or most firms, you're a generalist up until you kind of get to more of the senior levels. Mm-hmm.
Which means you could work on apparel, you could work on
apparel, automotive, food, automotive, you know, pet, whatever. But then for me, like, it just ended up being that Vinette and I kind of clicked really well, and the deal flow that, you know, the projects I was working on, they were beauty from the beginning. And through the, call it 11, 12 years I've been working with Vinette and the team at Financo, now Raymond James, basically one non-beauty deal, and then everything else has been beauty, and it's been like over 20, 25, lost track. Having said that, I'd say the kind of key thing around investment banking and just kind of getting deals done and everything, just having that kind of steel and grit of like figuring out what can we do to like drive everything forward. You know, it really very much is like big picture, but then the building blocks of everything you're doing is like the details, right? So all the basic things, the fundamentals around attention to detail and everything, that's all fine. I think some degree of optimism and just like getting it done is another one. And I think the critical thing that this kind of ties back to, you know, from the very beginning with my parents as therapists, within this particular sector, and part of the reason why I like still love it and everything, every deal is so different, we tend to work with founder-backed businesses and really coming down to like understanding the individual, who she is, what her motivations are. And a founder of skincare brand A versus skincare brand B, even if they're both selling in a very similar channel in Sephora and price points, the deal dynamics could be totally different because the people are very different. Mm-hmm. So kind of putting my psychiatry hat on, and you definitely feel this more senior you are, like you're really having to kind of figure out how can I best extract the best version of the founder, especially when it comes to the game time moments where you're sitting in front of, like, you know, the executive team at L'Oreal or, you know, so-and-so from Unilever. And I think that kind of almost like sports psychology coaching dynamic, I think, has been really interesting. And I found that dynamic, at least in my prior life, doing kind of a different sector, to be a little different. Whereas branding and the kind of X factor of the vibes, if you will, of a founder of a brand, those drive more of the kind of decision to, you know, buy a brand, or even down to the consumer of like, why do I buy this blush versus this blush? Whereas I feel like with maybe people think differently, but, you know, mortgage product A versus mortgage product B, or an insurance plan A versus B, it's less kind of emotional and more kind of like, what are the terms? And it's more kind of rational. So I think that.
So in your world, the specialty that you have in your team is that, like, you understand founders and the nuances of those relationships. So that would be different than another firm. Another firm might not have a reputation for being experienced with founders.
Well, I'd say there's a lot of other firms in the space that are, you know, good at what they do. You know, there's a lot of great banks and bankers out there. I'd say for us, the reputation that we have for being really good with founders, and I think critically, storytelling. What do founders do, especially in this space, all the time, all day long? It's storytelling. And the best brands are the ones that convey the best story, and, you know, connecting the product of what you're selling to kind of the channels and like that exact product market fit. We're also kind of seeing ourselves the same way. Like, you hire us ultimately to get something done, right? And the economics of what we do as investment bankers, like, we're kind of, even though the name investment banking, it's a little bit misleading. When I tell my grandmother or other family members who have no idea what they're doing, they're like, oh, like, can you recommend me a stock? I'm like, well, that's not really what we do. In M&A, you kind of almost think of us as real estate agents. Like, we work on commission, and instead of selling a home, we sell a company. Mm-hmm. And we get paid when the deal gets done. So everything comes down to what can we do to help our odds of getting something done. And whether it's really kind of figuring out how best to position the founder and all of her strengths, or how to best articulate what differentiates and makes this particular skincare brand or this particular hair care brand special in the sea of competition out there. I think that's kind of what makes it fun.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question the way your grandma would ask you a question. You're called an investment bank, but you're not holding money like a bank, right? So this is a misnomer too?
A little bit, yeah. Like, at the end of the day, like, investment banking, we basically are the conduit to basically connect the supply of capital and the kind of end destination of capital.
Right, but there are investment banking teams that are part of actual banks where money actually moves through the bank.
Yes.
You just happen to be a firm that does that, has that skill, but you're not actually a bank.
So Raymond James technically does have a bank.
Okay.
I'd say our M&A team, and, you know, this little bit of kind of like my old thinking with Financo, which is a boutique, they're pure play advisory. Mm-hmm. You know, the long story is, after kind of building our practice and kind of gaining more and more kind of success and kind of prominence, Raymond James then acquired Financo, and all of us, all 30 of us or so, basically overnight became Raymond James employees. We became basically their consumer and retail investment banking arm. And, you know, that's been like 4 or 5 years now under the kind of Raymond James umbrella. RJ, you know, they're a public company. They have the kind of classic investment banking arm. They also have wealth management, and they have like a small actual RJ bank
that
acts like a classic bank where, you know, they get deposits and they lend, you know, they pay deposits at X percent and they lend out at a higher percent. They do that too. But for what we're kind of talking about, classic investment banking, you know, M&A is a big part of it, raising capital, both equity and debt. like taking a company public. You know, we were involved in the Olaplex IPO, mm-hmm. for instance, and, you know, helping companies raise debt capital, that type of things. That's all part of what investment banks do. But to your point, kind of, you know, if I'm speaking to my grandmother, like, yeah, the semantics of what an investment bank is, it's oftentimes like, yeah, that's not what we do.
So let's go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is what was happening in the marketplace when you first got this role with on Vinette's team, which was a small team at the time. So it's just the two of you. I imagine it's not that just the two of you anymore.
Yeah, we have a much bigger team now. Yeah.
So this is what, 12 years? What is different now versus then? And when you say beauty, does that also mean like wellness,
yes,
personal care?
Wellness, personal care. And I think this is like, you know, this is a great observation, Jodi. I think the definition of beauty and personal mm-hmm. care and wellness, they're all kind of converging.
Yeah.
You know, you have increasing things around wellness. So what does that mean? It includes ingestibles and other things. And then you have things that are a little bit more on the kind of aesthetic medicine side with the rise of GLPs and like, in, you know, fillers, etc. Like it's all kind of growing, and the definition of beauty as we think of it today, it's wildly different than it was, you know, 10 years ago versus like 50 years ago.
Right. Well, Base Beauty, my day job, we specialize in beauty, wellness, and personal care, and we have to say those three categories because some like classic CPG marketers, they don't even know that they're part of this world, even though like they're selling deodorant, which is, yes, part of this world. We have a nomenclature issue in our industry, right? So we have to use all the terms to kind of make sure it's clear that you're part of this. So, okay. So tell me what's different now than 12 years ago in this space.
I'd say right now there's definitely more information, more attention, and with that, more capital availability. Mm-hmm. Back in, call it, 2013, 14, 15, when we were working with, for example, Lily Gordon of First State Beauty or Tiffany Masterson of Drunk Elephant and like all these other founders, the kind of ecosystem of like raising, you know, 5 million, 10 million of capital, there weren't that many pockets. Mm-hmm. And if you were trying to raise money like meaningfully below 5 million, there weren't very many places that were obvious. And I think now the kind of fundraising dynamic has been dramatically different. There's been a lot more interest and kind of awareness of like, oh, you know, beauty, personal care, wellness is a hot area. There's activity. From an investor's perspective, there's like an area where I can invest and then realize outsized returns. And there's been way more kind of focus and attention here. So now, you know, whether it's more on the VC angle where people are happy to write checks well below a million, like, you know, seed funding, pre-seed funding, and then, you know, Series A type things where it's like, you know, the check could be anywhere from a million to call it 10. And, you know, I think after this, you'll have some other folks who are kind of very much in that world who, you know, very much specialize in this area. And maybe in a prior life, they came from bigger companies, bigger funds that, you know, would deploy bigger checks. But I think something about beauty in that, you know, it attracts so much dynamism and founder kind of appetite and interest. And the kind of more exciting areas to some degree is in the smaller side of things where, you know, from a brand trying to scale from 0 million revenues to that first 5 or 10 million mark, beauty as we know it kind of in this day and age, the margins are really great. You can kind of spin up a Shopify site, a DTC site pretty quickly. You can kind of get the economics right and just, it's just go. And you don't need to raise tons and tons and tons of capital versus like restaurants or some other kind of area.
Right. Like if I'm going to start a car company, I need a lot of money.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or if you want to start like something that actually involves manufacturing and mm-hmm. opening a plant and all mm-hmm. that things, those are more kind of what we call capital intensive businesses. Where if you want to grow, you need that money. Whereas I think in classic beauty, especially now as the making of the products, the goop and bottle or jar can be outsourced to somebody else. It can be, you know, MOQs are now getting smaller. This kind of indie beauty world has definitely kind of increased dramatically over the past several years. So there's more interest. And I think all this, of course, stems from the consumer. Like, you know, not that long ago, like 20 or so years ago, beauty, as we all kind of knew it, was very much the big legacy brands, mm-hmm. like the Estee Lauders, the Lancomes, the Cliniques of the world. And I think with consumer tastes and preferences changing, and with technology and communications and social media and everyone kind of really understanding what are other people kind of up to, and the ability for smaller brands to like kind of get their brand out there in a way that wasn't possible before, like in the 1990s, 1980s, et cetera.
Yeah. I didn't have a crystal ball 18 years ago when I started Base Beauty, but I'm just so glad that I did and focused on beauty, wellness, and personal care because it's just a great adventure. Like, yeah. It is always changing, so slash exhausting, but so much fun, and you're making people's dreams come true, right? Yeah. Little tiny dreams at a time, right? Whether it's the right supplement that makes them feel better when they wake up in the morning, or the mascara that makes their eyes pop, or whatever it is. It's a really incredible place. I can imagine it's a breath of fresh air versus the mortgage business.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So let's go back to this topic that you mentioned before about like understanding like the needs and the emotions around a founder. We were talking offline before about a recent transaction where you were on the buyer side of a deal with a founder or a notable founder. I would imagine that even on the buyer side where your buyer, your client is not a founder business, that it probably made you more effective in that deal because you understood the person sitting on the other side of the table.
Yes, definitely.
So you don't have to reveal names, but if you can talk a little bit about how you use that, you know, psychology sort of approach to help your client who might be thinking more corporate understand what's happening on the minds of the deal, the other side of the deal.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd say with deal making, like, you know, on the surface, it's like, you know, the things that really matter that people kind of default to, like price and, you know, all the various kind of things there. But when it really comes down to it, advising the buyer to really, okay, what value do you want to kind of accomplish and where do you want to kind of go from here? Because getting the deal done, that's just step one. Mm-hmm. But then once you buy it, you want this to continue on growing and generating value under your purview, whether you want to hold it as a forever brand if you're a corporate or if you're a financial player or another player where the idea is to acquire it now, optimize it, grow it, help kind of shepherd it onto the next chapter to then maybe, you know, for yourself as well, sell it to the next kind of next buyer. And I think to accomplish that, you can think about deal making in a way and structuring things in a way to really kind of align incentives and to really understand the psyche of the founder. Like, what is she motivated? Like, what drives her? And also not just her, but her team as well. And I think having that lens of like understanding the kind of founder motivations, and, you know, money's of course just one thing, but in many times founders are kind of motivated by like seeing their brand, their baby, like to become the best possible version of it versus just an immediate kind of transaction mm-hmm. type of orientation. So I think that really, I think, helps. And then, you know, our client very much leans on us and our experience, especially on the other side, working with a lot of founders on the sales side, of like, what would be well received in context with kind of what's normal in this kind of marketplace.
Mm-hmm. I love that you're talking about setting up success for both players in the end, right? It's not just about this immediate transaction. It's about like what will happen next. And
Yes. That's
what Catherine and Lindy and I were talking about in the episode before you from Alex Partners. Like, we see it so many times, these global strategics buying these super hot, you know, magical brands, and then what? It's like they die.
Yeah.
And it's really sad, right? Because that's energetically a lot of humans' great work to get the business to be something that's such a exciting, promising entity. And then it's taken, you know, in-house by some strategic that's not prepared to build up that sparkle. Is that, do you think, possibly because in the deal stage, they weren't thinking about the future? It was just about the economics of the moment? Or is it other factors at play?
So generally speaking, most strategics, even though like when you're in the kind of press and the thick of things about beauty M&A and you see all these announcements, you think that, oh, like this is what they do. And to some degree, yes, like many of the majors, like, you know, take L'Oreal, for instance, like out of their 20 or 30 brands or so, like two of them were developed internally. Mm-hmm. Everything else was acquired at some point. So M&A traditionally is a core part of it, but most of these folks, they never acquire just to acquire. Like, they are operating companies and they always have that decision of like, okay, as a, you know, a company with finite resources, even though some of these major giants have like, practically speaking, a ton of money, they have to always make the decision, okay, with this capital, what do I need to do as a capital allocator? I can either, you know, reinvest it into my existing brands, to help them grow. I can incubate a new brand from nothing, or I can, you know, return money to investors and dividends, what have you. Or I can save some to acquire new up and coming businesses that we can then think to, you know, we can then accelerate this. All those things are kind of very much always on the top of mind. And a strategic company never has to do a deal. So oftentimes when we, you know, begin conversations with prospective founders who are thinking about, oh, like, I want to maybe do something. I want to, like, you know, speak to you, Kevin, about how this could, like, work and what do I need to do to, like, get XYZ strategic to be interested in me. And, you know, I understand that kind of orientation from founders. Like, you build all these things and you want to have that kind of culmination and that liquidity event. But brands are bought, not sold. You can do everything you can to kind of best optimize things both in the micro tactical level within the deal and also kind of in the process structure, but also, you know, building kind of the brand to, like, be the best brand it can be. But, like, that's really kind of it. Brands are bought for what they are in really solving a specific need in a specific moment in time for the corporate to be like, we need this particular capability that we see in the market is very much, we need to be here, but we don't have something internally that addresses that need.
Okay, I want to go back to this, brands are bought, not sold. You mean this is, like, the perspective of the seller is, like, you're trying to put the focus on what is going to happen next, not what do I need right now,
yeah.
Right? Like, less of a selfish focus and more of a, what am I putting forward?
Yeah, it's always about the future, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, with strategics, they're always thinking about, okay, what's in the value going forward, mm-hmm. for me? And I think most of these folks, they're thinking about, you know, forever brands, right?
Right.
Like, some of the kind of more iconic brands that we think of that are part of maybe, for example, L'Oreal's portfolio. Like, Lancome was bought at one point many, many years ago. Same thing with Kiehl's. It was bought many, many years ago. NARS was bought by Shiseido, you know, several years ago. And I think those things have been kind of built up and, you know, grown and integrated and kind of provided multi-year kind of value for the eventual, you know, parent company. Now, every deal kind of has that in mind. Not every deal ends up being a success like that. And I think some of it comes down to just, you know, maybe execution. Some of it comes down to a thinking that this brand can actually perform the way that we think it can in these channels, in these geographies, in these markets. But then the reality doesn't maybe shake up to, like, actually live up to those internal, you know, projections and ambitions.
Okay, so two questions before we get to our game. One is, you know, everything I've ever heard, like, the life of an investment banker is tough, like the hours, the pace.
Yeah.
Is this true?
Yes.
Okay, so for the people listening who might be earlier in their career and thinking that this is an exciting job, like, tell us what is it like? Like, what is the day-to-day? What happens when you're starting a deal? And how many, like, weddings and birthday parties did you have to drop out of to get jobs done?
So it is super exciting. And I think part of the excitement is no 2 days are the same. Like, you wake up and you have kind of calls scheduled and everything, but there's always something that kind of comes up out of left field and mm-hmm. you just have to adapt and adjust to it. M&A deals can take up to, like, 9 months, maybe even a year or more. And really kind of bringing everyone together to, like, sign a purchase agreement that definitively binds the buyer to buy mm-hmm. a brand. It's a big, big undertaking. And in many ways, at least, we very much believe this at Raymond James, you don't just start and then you think, like, okay, the timer starts now, 9 months later, we're going to get something done. Like, the prep work to really make sure that everything is ready and you have the best possible shot of getting something done.
Mm-hmm.
We very much believe in preparation is key, and that prep work can take, you know, a long time. Sometimes, like, you know, we've been hired by clients a year out in advance, and we've been, like, kind of slowly helping in the background mm-hmm. to kind of do that.
Wait, can I pause there a second? But you don't get paid until a deal is done?
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, in real estate, when I sell the house, I get my commission, but
yes.
I could show you 4,000 houses until
yes.
you buy one
yes.
over the course of 4 years.
And with that real estate example, you can show somebody 4,000 houses and they decide, actually, I'm not going to buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
All that time and energy and whatever, you're not compensated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's obviously, like, not a great kind of thing. And that's, like, the thing with us. Like, for investment bankers, the biggest currency we have is time.
Right.
So with that, you want to be the most efficient and kind of exacting of where you're spending your time.
Right. So that means that you're looking at, like, do I want to be attached to this brand for free for the next whatever amount of time. So you're probably at this point very discerning about who you choose to partner with.
Yeah, because like that's really your currency. Right. And I think, you know, from our perspective, like finding out the most dynamic brands that have the best shot of like, okay, there's something special here. They're tackling something, addressing something that, you know, and at that particular moment in time, no one else is doing, or they're doing in a way that's very differentiated. You know, I think in this category, the best possible brands that are doing something very different in a unique way, with a unique voice, they tend to have the best shot at getting something done. Mm-hmm. And I think other, whether it's investors or corporates, they're the ones who are like, wait, you can kind of see it in the data too. The consumers are voting with their dollars.
Right.
And they're like, we, like, what's happening here? Why is, back in 2017, 2016, why is Drunk Elephant gaining so much share? Mm-hmm. What are they doing that's different from the Sephora skincare set back in those days that's, you know, causing consumer love to be that dramatic? So, you know, those types of things are kind of things that we very much kind of focus on. But to answer your question around kind of the time, yeah, like you can have, especially early on in your career, like, you know, weeks that are like 90 hours, mm-hmm. 100 hours when things are kind of go, go, go. Sometimes you're not sleeping much at all.
Right. But are there days where it's like, okay, I leave the office at 5 and I go to the gym?
There are days where that happens. I'd say for me and for much of my career, that kind of transition of like, there are times in the middle of the day where like there's not much going on, mm-hmm. and then something changes at like 10 p.m. Yeah, or later.
Right, and you're essentially a global business. The transactions you're doing could be anywhere around the world.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, and I think that's another thing that I mentioned earlier on. Kind of, you know, the desire of wanting to do something that's like truly global. And yeah. I think one thing that was not so much the case in my prior life doing financial services investment banking, a lot of that is very localized, like regional bank in Ohio merging with the regional bank in Indiana. It's very kind of local, right? Whereas, you know, in the world of beauty, like especially in this stage of social media, trends that pop in the US are ported over to Dubai mm-hmm. right away. Mm-hmm. Same thing with London, you know, Australia, and like things now in this kind of recent K-beauty wave that we're having. Things in Korea are porting over here mm-hmm. through TikTok. So it's so kind of global and interconnected. And also with like me personally, like traveling wise, like of course there's a lot of domestic US travel. Mm-hmm. There's a huge beauty kind of community here in New York, same thing in California. But like a lot of the kind of corporate buyers of a lot of these brands in the category, they're all in Europe. So mm-hmm. or in Asia. Like so traveling kind of globally and seeing how beauty changes and how it's localized, but also how like the themes are also kind of rippling throughout the world. That's what's super exciting. You can kind of see it in like, you know, for example, the fragrance boom right now. Mm-hmm. It's truly, truly global. You know, walking through stores in Paris versus here in New York versus Los Angeles, like they're all kind of like, oh yeah, this is like, you know, we're all kind of global citizens together, all watching the same TikTok reel.
So is this a career where you can have a dog at home or no, if you live by yourself?
I do have a dog at home. Mm-hmm. I don't live by myself. My girlfriend Julie is here in the...
Hi, Julie.
In the guest room. So we've been living together now for like 7 months or so. Mm-hmm. She has a beautiful, beautiful, adorable toy poodle named Choco.
Choco.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. I have a Shiba Inu named Coco.
Choco and Coco.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we could not... planned this. It was just destiny, right? We get the names confused all the time. The dogs are also confused too.
Right, so I would imagine.
One of them, they uh-huh. just look at us. They're mm-hmm. like...
And they're both small?
So Choco is 6 pounds on a good day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Coco is like 22, 23
oh,
pounds.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And are they friends?
Now they're friends.
Okay. Yeah. But it was not easy in the beginning?
In the beginning. So Coco, she's turning 4 later in October. I'm not a father yet of an actual human child, mm-hmm. but I can kind of imagine... This is like the transition of having like an only daughter who's very much used to having kind of her domain mm-hmm. as like the undivided attention. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly overnight, there's like, what's this twerp doing eating my food? And that kind of tension point was like kind of interesting to see at first. But now like Coco very much like thinks of Choco as like, you know, her little brother and mm-hmm. very protective of him.
And Choco's a 6 pound.
Choco's okay. 6 pounds, yeah.
So Choco moved into Coco's home.
Yes.
And... Now it's lovely.
Now it's lovely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before 7 months ago, when you were living by yourself, this dog was fed and walked, even with the work schedule that you have?
Doggy daycare was a godsend. Okay.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Like, how often are you home? And will the plants survive?
I have a terrible green thumb. All the plants in my home dies. Like when it was just me, but Julie's really great at like watering plants and everything, mm-hmm. so we're good there. But yeah, with traveling, like yeah, like Coco would have to stay overnight at doggy daycare.
Right.
She became kind of the queen bee of doggy daycare mm-hmm. very quickly. But you know, now we have a dog walker coming in and everything, mm-hmm. so it's a little bit easier there. But yeah, it can be tough.
Okay, I do want to ask one more question before we move to the game, even though we're a little bit behind. You join Vinette and this team. It's just the two of you. Now you're a much bigger team, so now you're in a leadership position, and there's the people who are junior to you that are coming into this world wide-eyed, really excited the way that you were. What is your leadership style in getting them up to speed? Because beauty is nuanced, right? We have, like, even if you're a mass brand, you're treated like a luxury brand, right?
Yeah.
Like the personalities are pretty big. The marketplace is always changing. You go to sleep, and you wake up, it's a completely different business, right?
Yeah.
So what is your leadership style within the organization to build this team? Because the mastery of this is so important. Like you told me, like you want the best deals, which means like the marketing of your team is really important here.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd say understanding the kind of industry cold is one of the things that, you know, generally speaking, like folks who've been involved in beauty M&A for a while, they recognize us that our team top to bottom, we're the most fluent in beauty, and we're the ones who actually, when you spend time with us, it's less like you're speaking to bankers and finance mm-hmm. guys in suits. It's more like, oh, like you actually know what a Sephora retrofit is, mm-hmm. and like you know mm-hmm. what a, you know, the promo calendar is. I will say, just as a clarification, so it's myself, Vinette, and three other senior mm-hmm. bankers. So mm-hmm. Within the Raymond James kind of beauty, personal care, M&A coverage group, we have the most number of dedicated senior bankers mm-hmm. to kind of covering the world. In addition to Vinette, myself, we have my partner Evan, based in London, who does a lot of kind of Europe and ex-US coverage. We have my partner Marco Horvat, who's based in Miami, who does a lot of kind of four-wall med service kind of mm-hmm. efforts as well, especially kind of as we think about
beauty. Med spa, dental spa.
Exactly,
kind of
yeah.
Huh?
So as like kind of the definition of beauty and wellness becomes mm-hmm. a little bit more broader. And finally, my partner Jonah Wiesel, also based here in New York, who does a lot of kind of OTC and kind of, you know, like consumer health type mm-hmm. of things as well, especially as the convergence of that world and kind of traditional beauty converge.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, I tend to focus more on kind of classic prestige mm-hmm. beauty within a Sephora or department store environment. And I think for me, in terms of my leadership style, you know, I'm kind of the one who basically, whenever new folks come into our group, I take them out to our kind of somewhat infamous Sephora field trip.
Oh,
where
tell me.
I like literally walk them through, and these are kind of like bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, oftentimes men who come out of business school and they're like really wanting to get into finance and M&A and deal making. And they're like, we're going to Sephora. And I'm like, yeah. And then the initial kind of bit of like, I don't know what I'm doing. What's mascara? What's concealer? And then 6 months later, sometimes they like, you know, figure out like, okay, I'd rather do more food coverage. But then others, they have like really strong opinions about what mm-hmm. a 10-step skincare routine mm-hmm. should look mm-hmm. like. And they like go like, no, you have to apply this before this. And like, you know, mineral sunscreen or bust, or like they're very, very kind of it's actually like kind of rewarding in that sense to really figure out like, you know, from these guys too, like they then kind of, you know, modify their own behavior mm-hmm. as consumers.
Well, I just want to stay on that in a moment. To be successful in these categories, you have to love them. Like
yep.
We've had people join our team who are like, yeah, I like beauty. And then they get here and they're like, I don't like it this much, right?
Yeah.
You really have to be the consumer to do this work.
And I think engaging with where the brands sit in real life often is really important. Mm-hmm. So I think to the field trip end, you know, we take them over to the, you know, the Sephora, whether on 34th Street or in Union Square or Soho, and then we go through kind of that, especially when it's like kind of crazy and like, you know, like there's like a lot of activity. And then we go to Ulta
mm-hmm.
and then we go to a department store and they're like, wow, this is very different. And you can't really see and mm-hmm. understand it without being there yourself. We have tried now, especially as our analyst classes and as our kind of junior team has gotten bigger, I have to be a little bit more careful about breaking them into smaller groups. I can't bring 12 like mm-hmm. 22-year-olds suddenly like, you know, in suits, like writing notes. I had an instance where a Sephora store manager was like, can I help you?
You're a little too conspicuous.
Yeah. So
Okay, we're going to move on to the next phase of our conversation, which is our game. I loved everything we talked about, and I want to find you offline because there's so many more things I want to chat about. But, okay, so we are going to play a game around your personal passions. You told us coffee and wine tasting are of interest to you. So we're going to play a game of this or that around life in New York City, where you're spending your time and money around coffee and wine tasting. So I have a few themes for you. There's no right or wrong answer. But it gives us a peek into your world. Now we know you're taking the dog with you probably, so that might influence your decision. So first topic, coffee lovers edition. Are you going to spend your time in Greenwich Village at Stumptown Coffee Roasters, which is famous for its bold and delicious brews? This is not an advertising thing, this is just research. Or are you going to Devotion, am I pronouncing that right, coffee in Brooklyn? It's a stunning cafe with a tropical vibe. Where are you taking Choco? Okay. Where are you going? Greenwich Village or Brooklyn, Stumptown or Devotion?
So I'm a huge fan of Devotion.
Okay.
Their original location in New York was in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. but they've opened since new locations closer to where I live in Nomad. So they have one in Nomad, one in Flatiron. That's like kind of very much our go-to ritual Saturday mornings.
Okay.
Walking the pups and getting coffee there. But Stumptown is classic. Like they're great in like Greenwich Village, like, you know. It's always nice walking around there.
And it's dog friendly, Devotion?
No one has told me Coco's not allowed.
Oh, okay.
So I just kind of roll with it.
Got it.
Yeah.
Next scenario, wine lovers edition. Are you going to go maybe with the dogs, but probably with Julie, Blue Ribbon Brasserie in Soho? It's a quaint wine bar. Or are you going to Staffili in West Village? It's a Greek inspired wine cafe.
Staffili actually has been on my list. I've not been yet, but I probably will go there. Like, there's very specific things that, you know, I love places that have a very specific point of view mm-hmm. and a focus of, like, you're coming here for Greek wine, Croatian wine, this, that, and having that kind of point of difference. And I love kind of like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Let's go through it.
Okay. You know? I mean, that's exactly what you do in your day job, too.
Basically, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, coffee meets wine. Are you going to spend your time at Andrew's New York City Diner in Midtown? It's a cafe that turns into a wine bar in the evening. Or, oh, it's known for its chilled rosé. Or are you going to Cafe Mogadori?
Oh,
Mogadori in cafe, East Village?
Cafe Mogador is excellent. Mogador, their food okay. is fire.
Okay, tell me why.
Well, it's like North African Moroccan cuisine. And like that's probably one of Julie and my favorite places. Like they have like a lamb dish and a chicken dish that's just like, oh, so good.
Okay, so maybe we'll have lunch there together.
Yes.
Okay, last scenario. You're cruising down Fifth Avenue. Would you rather sip an iced latte from Joe Coffee Company on the Upper West Side or enjoy a glass of sparkling wine at the bar at the Baccarat Hotel?
Oh, that's tough. It really depends on the mood and mm-hmm. everything. Like, I don't know, like part of like the, I think the beauty of consumer choice, like it really comes down to like, what version of Kevin am I getting at that particular moment? Uh-huh. And with that, you know, sky's the limit in terms of optionality and everything.
We are dynamic creatures.
We are dynamic right? creatures.
And we can be at the Baccarat Hotel or we can be in our flip-flops with an iced coffee in hand.
Absolutely.
Kevin, this is so much fun. I'm so glad we got to do this today. Thank you for everybody in the audience, too, for listening in.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Where Brains Meet Beauty with Jodi Katz. Tune in again for more authentic conversations with beauty leaders.